Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
We need a kid like you to test this accidentally smaller version on the lunar surface and soon.
Stan, you're our only hope.
Okay.
Richard Linklater's latest, Apollo 10 and a Half, is a nostalgic and fantastical evocation of the 60s-era space race and its influence on the imagination of a suburban Houston fourth grader. One of my favorite directors tackling one of my favorite subjects when I was a fourth grader? Yes, please.
It is pretty much the right stuff, Junior. That's true. We've got a review of Apollo 10 and a Half and our top five Richard Linklater scenes. That and more.
Baby, you're going to miss that liftoff.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
Welcome to Film Spotting. I have no idea why I made Julie Delpy have such a low voice.
I didn't quite recognize her.
Going for sultry, and I did not pull that off at all. We've got some options here, Josh. We can talk about the Oscars, which I know you watched, and I did not because I never do, or we can just not talk about the Oscars. I'm going to leave it to you.
I mean, you don't think I have the perfect, the long-awaited final authoritative take on what happened at the Oscars?
Come on, Adam. Pun intended.
Here's what I'll say about Chris Rock, Will Smith, and Jada Pinkett Smith. What got lost in all of that, Jada, to my mind, the best dressed of the evening. You want to hear my quick top three, Adam? I know you love this part, and
oh man,
you rely on me to report
what
back.
Have I gotten
on the red carpet
into
Jada? Seriously, it was like an organic train she had that just extended of its own will. Even once the show began, when they cut to the audience, you could see it kind of laying out there. So that all got lost in the kerfluffle. Close behind her, though, Lupita Nyong'o had this dress that was cinematic. Like when she was walking, there was movement to it. It had these sort of flares. That was my second pick. And then you had to have seen Kristen Stewart wearing the shorts, Adam. Come on.
No.
Is this the first you're hearing of that?
I did not hear anything about Kristen Stewart.
She wore shorts to the Oscars.
I didn't hear anything about what anybody wore until now or what anybody won. It was all just Will Smith, Chris Rock, all the time.
Well, see, I'm here to fill in the gaps for you. I thought it was fun that Kristen Stewart did that. And seriously, I do want to say one thing, which I did put on Twitter, too. I feel bad I failed Coda. I know you saw it, and I know you didn't think it was like among the greatest movies of last year.
Yeah, but worth seeing, absolutely.
Well, and I felt, you know, as you learn more about it, as the ceremony went on, it wasn't just that it won that made me feel that way, but also you see the sort of representation involved and the scenes they showed, you know, looked pretty strong. They looked like strong scenes.
I was going to ask you this, though. I saw your tweet and I'm wondering why now, though? Was it just seeing the scenes? Because
what I just said.
You knew, though, that it had a shot at winning, right?
What do you mean? That I was surprised that it took Best Picture.
Yeah, me too. But you knew it was, at least if I think back to our terrible predictions that we made, we thought it would win at least one.
Yeah, I think we both picked Troy Kotsur. So so it was partly his speech, you know, and what I said is just seeing a few clips from it. So I'm not promising like that it's going to knock out any of my top 10 picks. Probably not likely from the other things I've heard about it, but I am going to promise to check it out. I'm going to do that.
Get nominated for a Best Picture. You're not on Larson's radar. Win Best Picture. You're in.
I'll make time for you.
Later in the show, we use the occasion of Richard Linklater's new film as an excuse to replay our top five Linklater scenes. We did that top five back in 2016, back when Everybody Wants Some came out. Not all of our picks are from the Before series or Dazed and Confused, just most of them. Podcast listeners will get some final foretalk Film Spotting Madness edition, though I know a small portion of our audience loves it when you talk hoops, Josh. Our best of the 70s tourney is down to four titles, and yeah, they're probably the very four you'd guess they'd be.
Finnish hoops specifically, Adam. Mm-hmm. First, though, Houston, we have another Texas-specific movie from Richard Linklater, Apollo 10 and a Half.
Let me tell you about life back then. Living in the Houston area in the late 60s, it was a great time and place to be a kid. But the world was changing, and so was how we saw ourselves in it.
Right on.
Mom, is that one a hippie?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a hippie.
How about that one?
No, his hair's not long enough.
But he's wearing bell bottoms.
Okay, that's a hippie.
I think I like hippies.
Richard Linklater, like his main character Stan, was born in 1960. And Josh, if you had asked me prior to watching Linklater's very autobiographical Apollo 10 and a half, how similar our childhoods likely were to his, I would have guessed not much at all. He experienced the 60s, albeit mostly as a grade schooler. We came of age in the 80s. I mean, setting aside any cultural differences between his suburban Houston boyhood and our Midwestern upbringings, surely we emerge from two vastly different universes. He watched live as astronauts Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins landed on the moon in July 1969 and fantasized about taking their places, while we repeatedly watched Aldrin plant a colorful animated flag on the moon emblazoned with the letters MTV every time we flipped the channel to music television, which launched in 81. I'm pretty sure we didn't discover cable at our house for another 4 to 5 years, though. So for a sizable portion of my youth, I remember having three channels, 5, 8, and 13 back in central Iowa, same as Stan and his sizable family. Everyone gathering around the TV once a year to watch The Wizard of Oz? Yep, that happened too. Chasing down foul balls at the local diamond and returning them to the concession stand for a snow cone? Check. Except I think we might have gotten a whole quarter for that we then used to pay for a snow cone. We occasionally had to duck and cover in school, too, in preparation for a potential tornado, not nuclear fallout, and the soundtrack to our nightly dinners wasn't the reporting of casualties in Vietnam, among other distinctions. But I'm now convinced that maybe our kids aren't off base when they call us boomers. Linklater, applying a combination of performance capture and 2D and 3D animation that is unique from the rotoscoping technique of Waking Life and A Scanner Darkly, recalls all of these rituals and realities with vivid specificity and, mostly, sweetness. Was that specificity and sweetness satisfying for you, Josh? If so, how much of your satisfaction do you attribute to okay boomer nostalgic recognition? Or is this simply what Linklater has always excelled at, taking everyday experiences and elevating them, in this case, all the way to the moon and back?
Immensely satisfying for both of the reasons you just said, because Linklater is skilled at this sort of thing and because it is rooted in, I mean, really what you're identifying and what this movie identifies is a white, middle America, middle class, suburban upbringing. Mm-hmm. And that there is evidence in this movie that that didn't change for a long time in this country, that it lasted, you know, almost two generations for some people. And there are good things and there are bad things about that, because the flip side is that, what about the people who didn't have this rosy experience? Why didn't they have that rosy experience? Was it not offered to them? Was it not allowed for them? And there is a touch in here I hope we get back to that connects with Questlove's Oscar-winning documentary, Summer of Soul.
Sophie and I recognize
found
that, the quote.
Fascinating and
the soundbite.
Really instructive to kind of reposition this out of my own nostalgic lens and haze. There's been a conversation going on, you know, regarding the movie, actually, that we're going to talk to for our bonus show for our Patreon subscribers, the Film Spotting family, Adam, Turning Red, a review that said something about, I'm just gleaning this from Twitter, all the uproar on Twitter, about how it was not a relatable story. And some of the responses to that were pointing out that, well, was it not relatable to this particular reviewer because it's coming from the perspective of a immigrant family in Canada and from a girl, a preteen girl. And is that why it maybe was described as unfamiliar? And so we could say the flip side of that, okay, is something like Apollo 10 and a half going to be overpraised by people like us, Adam, for its familiarity and its nostalgia and its comfortability? I think that's an interesting conversation to have, and I don't think it means there's, you know, one film is on the right side of it, one film is on the wrong side of it. I do think it's probably why I appreciated it more, though, is because I do respond to both those elements you're talking about. I respond to the craft, which I think anyone could, whatever their background was. Mm-hmm. And then their lens, you know, Debbie, the children's librarian, Debbie, my wife, talks a lot about, and a lot of librarians do, you know, to students, whether books are a window or a mirror. And it's the window or mirror question, right? So for you and me, Apollo 10 and a half is more of a mirror experience. But there might be someone else, as Turning Red was, partly for me, where it's a window experience. And I think that's where the craft is what's going to sustain the movie. Now, might you and I value it more because we can say, oh, I remember going to the drive-in like that.
Yeah, maybe.
Because we can say, oh, I used to fight for a place on the couch. Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it's also recognizing the reality that there were probably other families that didn't even have a couch like that to sit, didn't have a TV to watch the moon landing on for whatever reason, you know? And so, again, I love that Linklater nods to that, but this film's value is probably going to be determined, I think, in how much you respond to it personally. And again, it's interconnected with his talent because he gets those details so right, so exactly right.
Yeah, I also made a Turning Red connection that we may get to here, though, in praising both films, ultimately. I think that the film does do a good job of acknowledging his privileged position without it being a case where Linklater is, of course, couching it in the terms that we would actually use today, or feeling at all like it is from a defensive posture or that it's obligatory. It feels genuine. It comes through in some of the moments, like I referenced the recurring sounds of Walter Cronkite and the images from TV. And the acknowledgments, like when they see the hippie or the hippies on the street, there's acknowledgement that there is another world outside of the world they live in. But the thing is, when you're 8 or 9 years old, like Stan is, you only know, even when you have it encroaching in those ways, you really only know and understand what's happening kind of in your block, in your school, in your home. And I think a lot of us are inclined to look back on that a little fondly, at least if we are able to reflect on it in those positive terms. And I think we'll get into that a little bit, the prism through which Linklater via the storyteller is looking back on Stan, but then also this version of Stan in the fantasy, I think is informed by a certain feeling of wistfulness that he didn't understand what he had when he had it as well. And only in retrospect can you really look back on it and realize how good that you had it. You may not be able to realize that other people have it worse, but you don't even fully appreciate what you have. And I think the window or mirror notion there does really apply. You're right. For us, it's a bit more of a mirror, but I think that we respond usually just as strongly to films that have this level of detail and specificity because they are that window. I don't need to relate exactly to the experience. And as I noted, there are things about the experience that I don't connect to, though we joked about it in the intro of the show. Yeah, when I was this age, I was obsessed with space. The first story I ever wrote, the first piece of fiction I ever wrote, it was for a class assignment, was after seeing The Right Stuff and imagining myself as one of those astronauts. So yeah, I've truly been where Linklater has been and where he's coming from with this movie. But I'll just add to what you said about Linklater and him being uniquely suited to this material. Yes, because of the obvious correlation to his life, but also because of the way this movie exists in this dreamy realm between reality and fantasy, like Waking Life does, like A Scanner Darkly does. But, you know, to jump ahead or to jump back to our top five Linklater scenes, that line from Boyhood about there being real magic in the world. It was my number one Linklater scene because I think it so encapsulates what he's trying to do as a filmmaker. He's always been interested in finding the transcendent in the ordinary. And what's more ordinary than being a fourth grader at a school in Texas and playing with your siblings and making lunches for the week and watching all your favorite TV shows? Juxtaposed, though, with the extraordinary, an event that almost transcends our ability to comprehend it, a man walking on the moon and returning. And the fact that this movie starts, I wonder if this did catch you off guard as much as it did me, even though then, of course, it all clicked in and you said, yeah, it has to be this way. It could only be this way. This movie starts and jumps into the plot, so we think, right away. The first 8 to 10 minutes are all about a kid at school, and NASA comes to him and says, you're going to be an astronaut. And he goes and starts training to be an astronaut. I'm like, who's directing this film? Mm-hmm. This isn't a Richard Linklater movie. And about the exact point where I'm thinking that, the narrator, voiced by Jack Black, says something like, well, wait, maybe I should give you a little bit more background on what life was like for me. And that pretty much becomes the entire rest of the movie.
Right. Yeah, for a long time until we return to the fantasy. You could make an argument that the movie doesn't need the fantasy. I don't know that I needed it. I don't think it takes away from it. But I will tell you, when we return to it, I was kind of like, oh, I just want to see what happens with this family the next morning, which is kind of wild because you feel like maybe the fantasy was inserted to goose this thing up a little bit. And I don't know, maybe some people definitely need that. But for me, I probably would have been happy without it. Both of these elements, though, Adam, I want to talk about the animation in terms of how it relates to both of them, because I think it does the same thing. And you're right, it's not entirely rotoscoping like those previous films were. It does employ that, you know, digitally painting over live action footage. So some of it looks familiar. What's interesting to me is how it has a different effect, at least particularly for Scanner Darkly, which I remember a little bit better, and just being this sort of a paranoid and psychedelic experience. Yeah. That was the experience of that animation.
Mm-hmm. You can't really get your footing.
You can't get your bearings. Yeah. And here, it's a similar style, but employed in a way that makes it feel storybookish. And that applies to the space fantasy sequences of Stan training and then eventually going off into space. It has a storybook quality. But I think the storybook quality is key as well to these memories being depicted. If this had been made in live action, I think the tendency, as much as I love a movie like A Christmas Story, might have been to be a little more broad, or it might have come across as more broad.
Yeah.
You know, in that vein. And there's just something picture book quality about using the animation here. So I think that's crucial. And I just want to name a couple of details for listeners who, you know, have not seen this or even watched the trailer or anything, just to give them an idea about what we're talking about. We've mentioned some memories we had and how we shared them, but I'm talking even more specifically. This is a movie that gives 10, 15 seconds to the fact that Stan remembers every time his dad would pop open a can of beer, he would drop the tab into the can. Yeah. And then he kind of, if I remember correctly, he kind of pauses and wonders why. Like, why? And that's the merging of perspectives you're talking about, Adam, where we get it depicted. We see it happening as he's narrating it. But then you do get that wistfulness. You get the voice, Jack Black, saying, you know, kind of looking back on it and for the first time pausing to think about it. The lineup of the family on a Sunday night making sandwiches for the entire week of school, you know, so that they're all prepared. Just the details that go into that as well. It's just endless. That's almost the entirety of the film. We could go on and on listing things like these, but those are two specific examples. I don't know if there was one or two that you wanted to highlight where you were just like, wow, this is just such great stuff.
Yeah, well, I love the scene with one of his brothers in the garage where they're playing their makeshift baseball game.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and we all did that. We all made up games like that with our own rules, and then we fought with each other about it. I think your point, I just want to echo real quick about the animation and how it functions here, is really important, because I agree. I think there would have been something way more sentimental about it had it been live action. It just wouldn't have been avoidable. Whereas with the animation, it can be this dream-like experience. One other detail, though, I wanted to mention. I actually love the fact that when he's talking about television and how important television was to them, and he lists his shows, he lists like 30 shows. He doesn't list his favorite one, two, or three. He does single out Dark Shadows a little bit, but there's that part where he riffs and he says, here's what we had. And he lists, I think, every single show that was probably on all three networks at the time. And it just, to me, suggests this idea that looking back on it, it's like life was so good. Not only was there not scarcity because we only had three channels, there was actually an abundance of amazing options. Even the network offerings were idyllic or seemed that way. I do want to go back to what you said about why we needed or not the space part. I do think we needed it. I mean, besides the fact that clearly for Linklater, this recognition of this moment and this overlap of this time in the 60s where the future seems to be becoming reality and where life seems to be changing very rapidly. I said that he looks back on it mostly sweetly, and I think that's true. But here's what really lingers with me about Apollo 10 and a half, and maybe here's where I'll mention Turning Red. Maybe it's because I watched Turning Red the next day and I couldn't help but make this connection, or I was in this headspace. Stan here is not quite ready for puberty, but he does seem to be at a crossroads. He's in this place in time, as I said, where everyone is obsessed with the future and they're rushing to get there. And he obviously gets caught up in that too. He imagines himself as an active participant in that. But, you know, he's not fantasizing about being a man like Neil Armstrong. He still wants to be himself. He still wants to be a kid experiencing the extraordinary. He wants to sit in the module or the cockpit waiting for liftoff, reading Mad Magazine, just like he would if he was on his couch at home or in the car with his parents. It's only as the storyteller that he's able to look back on it, right? And say, oh, wait, it maybe never actually got better than this. You had everything you could possibly want. And in the moment, you were imagining yourself constantly trying to escape it. So for me, the lingering images of the movie aren't of Stan the astronaut portraying his excitement or the thrill he's experiencing at doing something incredible, walking on the moon, the first man on the moon, the first boy on the moon. It's actually in that last 20 minutes or so, the real feeling of melancholy I got. It's the distance. It's the loneliness. And it struck me as though we're seeing it through the eyes of the storyteller truly in that moment and through the eyes of Linklater as the omnipotent storyteller who's looking back, and even the fantasy version of Stan that has been presented to us, he's seeing that through the eyes of someone who is looking back on it a little bit mournfully, you know, as if something was lost and that he's on the verge of a type of change in his life that maybe he's truly not ready for. And he actually wishes he could dial back or have back.
I think it's absolutely a perspective of longing for what's lost, what's gone away in this movie. It's especially interesting that Stan is the youngest of five or six, I forget.
I think he has five siblings.
Yeah, that sounds right. So a big family. Yeah. Yet, you know, he's not longing in the movie. Young Stan, there are times where he regrets that. That's why he ends up on the floor, right? Not with a seat on the couch. But you don't get the sense that he's urging to be one of the older kids so much. He's pretty happy where he is. And I think that's partly how the narrator is presenting it, which is tied back to that longing. And what you're describing as him wanting to be in the space mission, but as a kid, well, that's the sweet spot, right?
Yeah.
That's where you're getting to do the adventurous stuff, but you don't have any of the responsibilities. You don't have to go to Vietnam then, right? Because you're not old enough. Not that Stan is necessarily thinking about those things, but it's on the TV in the background. So it's probably in the back of his head somewhere. So there are those certain things about adulthood, like the space missions that he wants to be a part of, other things he doesn't. So if you're the kid in the shuttle or in the pod, you know, then you don't have to worry about that other stuff. You're really sitting in the sweet spot. I love how this ends, and I'm not going to spoil it, but let's say how Stan experiences the actual moon landing. I think that is not only so recognizable, not only like one of those things where it's like I could physically feel the experience of being in a situation like that at that age, but also tied into this notion of looking back on these days with longing, because right. that was a space of safety and rest that maybe has been difficult for this narrator to find as an adult. I think that's the sense we get. I think what we're getting around here is not only the material, but Jack Black really good as the narrator, you know, capturing yeah. all of that. You're pretty sure it's Jack Black, you know, after you hear him, but he's not doing a voice, you know, he's not doing a bit here. I think he's really good. Can I ask you something back to where you started with just, you know, the things you remember that were in this mm-hmm. film, but it's weird because this is the 60s, not the 80s. So when did the break, and obviously it's just in the context of what we see in this movie, but I do wonder when the break happened, when that next generation sort of took over, because I can right. remember the TV being wheeled into a classroom still for yep. launches, right? When I was pretty little, they were still doing that. So I don't know if it was like, if it was a cable thing, if it was... or if it wasn't until the internet where that divide is, but there does, the fact that we can connect with a generation some 20 some years earlier makes me think, okay, a line must have drawn,
yeah.
been drawn not long after us. I don't know what drew that line, whether it was entertainment technology or whatever it might have been, but I think you're right that it clearly was after our childhoods.
Yeah, it was. That was why I had to have some fun with that, because that really was such a surprise to me watching this film. I haven't really paid a lot of attention to those generational divides and what the driving forces were behind them. But as I suggested, it just seems odd at first blush that someone who was born in 1960 had so much overlap with the experience we did. And we came, you know, in the mid 70s. So we were sort of late period Gen Xers. He's late period boomer. And yet things didn't change. Things didn't completely change until sometime after the childhood that we're both recalling. Maybe TV was it. TV is such a huge part of this movie when you think about it, not just as the backdrop for their meals, for their entertainment. They're watching it all the time. And the moment that you describe, really the climax of this film, in a lot of ways is a TV moment. It's them watching this play out. Of course, we see what's also playing out in his head, but it really is the experience they're having, taking it in as a family, watching it on television. I don't know if MTV and cable is really when
things changed,
but it had to be connected, Josh. It has to be part of it.
As you described, it is contained TV. There were three channels. There were only so many shows. And it's almost as if once cable opened up that world, there were more punctures in the bubble. Again, this goes back to our particular background, a middle class, white, suburban bubble. But there were only certain ways to puncture it. The news reports, comments your parents made about hippies or something like that. You know, we had similar bubbles, I think. And for mine sure. was extended. We never got cable in my childhood. So mine was even extended. And now, of course, you know, that's where the internet is tied in too. Now all that stuff is not only on 110 channels in your home, it's in the palm of your hand and your kids' hands if they have mm-hmm. phones. So yeah, that seems, you know, at first blush to kind of seem to be it to me. And that reminds me, I do want to just go back to that Summer of Soul moment, because when we reviewed the documentary last year, I think we probably talked about the one interview with a festival attendee in Harlem. This happens to be taking place during the moon landing, right?
Yeah.
This festival. And this guy is rightfully asking all the money that is being spent to send a couple of guys to just land on the moon and come back. Think of what we could do with it in Harlem, where there is great need, right? And what do we get but a recreation of that, again, using this animation technique, this rotoscoping of, I'm pretty sure, that exact same interview.
Yeah.
And so I think the way you described it is right. You know, this is a delicate line Linklater has to walk to be true to his experience and at the same time recognize that his experience is not universal. And that's where the two of us need to be careful using the term universal to describe this movie, because it's not. It's not really. No. And so I think it's very smart of Apollo 10 and a half to offer some acknowledgement of that. And I think it's cool that it connects with Summer of Soul.
Yeah, I agree. Apollo 10 and a half, currently playing in limited release, and it is streaming exclusively on Netflix. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
So Jack Black also finds his way into our lists of the top five Linklater scenes, alongside more expected faces like Ethan Hawke and Matthew McConaughey. Our picks are next, along with the final four of Film Spotting Madness. Dun-dun, dun-dun. Stay with us.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
What's happening?
Everyone, I'm not your husband. I'm another version of him from another universe. I'm here because we need your help.
Very busy today. No time to help you.
Michelle Yeoh there with Jonathan K. Kwan in the trailer for Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. The new film from the directing duo Daniels hits limited release this weekend before expanding wide in a couple of weeks. The plot, in short, Michelle Yeoh enters the multiverse. We thought we were multiversed out after Spider-Man, Josh, but you've seen this film. Would you like to tease the review at all?
I think it's going to be great to talk about. I think you should buckle in before seeing it. And if you have the option and are comfortable doing so, definitely try to see it in a theater, because the crowd that I saw this with, yes, it was a promotional screening, so take that into account. But there was more than one instance of straight up applause in the middle of the movie. And, you know, we go to a lot of promotional screenings. That doesn't happen often. So I think it was fairly genuine. So, yes, as the title suggests, a lot going on here, comes at you very quickly and will give us a ton to talk about.
We're going to talk about that in a few weeks. We're saving it for its wide release, in part because you are off next week, Josh, though that doesn't mean you are off from working and talking about cinema. You are going to be out in Boulder, Colorado for Ebert Interrupt Us.
Yeah, I guess this is work. It's pretty much a dream getting to do this each year, but it is the Interrupt Us program at the Conference on World Affairs. And we're doing Jaws, as I've mentioned a couple times on the show already, the first Spielberg film to be examined as part of Interrupt Us over decades of its history. They've never done Spielberg. So it's Jaws this year. We're going to look at it over a couple of days, taking it a frame at a time if we have to. Anyone who's there can shout stop and offer a comment or ask a question. So that is April 6th through 9th. I will be gone next week. It's at the University of Colorado Boulder. Special alert for Film Spotting listeners. Even if you can't make any of the Interrupt Us, you are still invited and welcome to join us for the Film Spotting meetup.
Oh, that's not fair. No. They got to go and listen to you break down Jaws if they want a free drink. Come on.
I'm not that stringent, Adam. Saturday night is the date. We've got a place. We've got a time. 8 p.m. right there in Boulder. It's at The Sink. Those who have come in previous years, it's the same spot. We'll have wrapped Interrupt Us up a couple of hours earlier, so it'll be a nice celebration of that. But again, if you just live in the area and can't make it until Saturday night, we'd love to see you there. We'll put the details in the show notes.
Next week on the show, we don't know what we're going to have, or I don't know what I'm going to have, because Josh is going to be off breaking down Jaws scene by scene. We might share some interviews. I might do the thing I like to do from time to time and bring on some filmmakers, or maybe I'll see what Michael Phillips is up to and we'll chat for a little bit. You're just going to have to wait and see. We do try to update the show schedule regularly online. If you go to filmspotting.net and click on episodes at the top, the schedule is there. It's not all that common that we have whole weeks where we have no clue what we're doing. But you know what? We'll get through this show, Josh, and we'll come up with one for next week.
I'm just going to say, Adam, it's okay to take a break.
Oh, we could do that?
Yes. Some people, I don't know if you've heard of this, but around this time of the year, some people go on what they call a spring break.
A spring break.
I think you should allow yourself that grace and consider that. Just throw that in the mix.
Won't people stop listening then?
I think they'll come back.
Okay. This week over on our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show, they've got the new film from director Ty West. It's called X. One I am pretty eager to catch up with because you know me. I'm a scaredy cat, Josh. There's not a lot of horror I'm excited to see. Can't wait to rush to the theater to see, or God forbid, watch by myself on my couch in the dark. But I really like Ty West films, and great pairing here based on what I know about X. They're comparing it to Tobe Hooper's Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
I mean, I'm telling you, I did not ask them to do this for me, but I'm so
glad. They're helping you with your book.
Helping me with my homework. I'm in the middle of writing the Slashers chapter for Fear Not, my Christian appreciation of horror. And yeah, literally like just 2 days ago, I was writing about Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I watched it about 10 days ago. Again, scared the everything out of me, even though I watch it on a laptop in a sunny room on the afternoon. It still really worked. So I cannot wait to hear what the folks have to say about it on the Next Picture Show. I promise not to steal anything for the book. Your hosts are Tasha Robinson, Keith Phipps, Scott Tobias, and Genevieve Kosky. New episodes of the Next Picture Show post every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts, and you can find more information at nextpictureshow.net.
This is blasphemy. This is madness!
This is absolute madness.
This madness!
But this is absolute madness, Ambassador. Why should you build such a thing?
Madness. This is Sparta!
All right, Film Spotting Madness, final four time, Josh. Unlike the NCAA, we do not, for better or worse, have a sneaky 8 seed playing for a chance to advance to the final. The four titles that made our final four were the exact films we thought would make it this far. The top 4 seeds is all chalk here in Film Spotting Madness. I guess Sam and I either really know our 70s cinema, Sam and I being the bracket committee here, either know our 70s cinema or know our listeners' feelings about 70s cinema. Now, the cruel irony of this is we knew that, and yet neither of us followed that same logic when we filled out our prediction brackets.
So what's going on there? Are you kind of thinking in order for one of you to beat the other, you're going to have to take a left turn and hope you took the right left turn?
Yeah, it's kind of like what I do with my actual March Madness brackets that are always a disaster. Well, almost always a disaster. You got to zag at some point, okay, right? And I thought, well, you'll hear about it in a little bit, but Sam and I both thought that zag might just be another Coppola film, Apocalypse Now, making its way to the final four. And, you know, they ran into a shark. It happens
it
sometimes,
does happen,
right?
Yes.
To the best of films. The final four round of Film Spotting Madness Best of the 70s is live right now. Go to filmspotting.net to vote. Filmspotting.net/madness will take you right there. Voting closes Monday, April 4th at 11 a.m. Central Time. A new round will go live on Tuesday. That championship match, in this case, we do give our family members on Patreon a first shot at the polls. So what are you voting in? Let's share the Elite Eight results. And we will go in order of the seeding here, Josh. Number one seed, The Godfather, went up against Ridley Scott's Alien.
We always like to share comments we got from voters. Here's Dustin. The Godfather may be the best mobster movie out there, but there are a lot of good mobster movies, including another really good Godfather. Alien is singular, and I don't think there has really been anything like either before or since. Even its own sequel had to radically shift genres to find success. That is a movie that deserves to make it to the final four, something wholly unique, unreproducible, and irreplaceable. Before we get to the results, Adam, is that logic you considered at all? Because it's pretty intriguing, the fact that there are other very good mobster movies out there.
Yeah, it's definitely good logic, especially as Dustin rightfully notes, there's another really good Godfather movie in the tournament, in the Elite Eight. So you could very easily say, and I think you even might have done this, you only picked one of them because you said, maybe we don't need both. And I said, no, I got to go with my heart. I looked inside my heart and both Godfather movies had to be there. Great reasoning, though. Well argued by Dustin. And you'll notice a trend here with the feedback. Sam is trying to pick out feedback that praises the movies that ultimately got crushed and ended up in the incinerator, because none of these were really close. Godfather took down Alien 67-33%.
Yeah, that's a beating. All right, our number two seed, Star Wars, went up against Chinatown. Caleb Turner shared some thoughts here. This one's the easiest matchup of the Elite Eight. Disney has thoroughly poisoned the well more than enough to override my nostalgia. Forget it, Luke. It's Chinatown. Wow.
Yeah, Caleb in the minority to the tune of only 39% voting for Chinatown. Star Wars is victorious with 61% of the vote. Here's the matchup I mentioned earlier. The one that I knew my bracket would turn on. Sam knew it too. Jaws, the number three seed versus Apocalypse Now, which I think might have been the five or six seed. Adam Grossman says, elite level film versus elite level film. It's the kind of madness only Film Spotting madness can deliver. But my vote is a clear one. On absolutely every level and whatever version you watch, Apocalypse Now remains one of the most truly transcendent pieces of cinema ever created. Is it true, Josh, that if Apocalypse Now won out, you would have had to swap it in for Ebert Interruptus over Jaws?
Yes, that's what was at stake here. Absolutely. Yeah. So good thing it didn't happen. All my preparation was not in vain. Jaws pretty easily. Another easy win here. 67%-33%.
So when you were filling out your bracket, when you were predicting which one you thought would win, you did correctly pick Jaws over Apocalypse Now. Did you think that it would win by this margin? Did you think that was a slam dunk?
No.
Jaws?
I think that, but I do think this is a case of where my strategy of wondering if voters think there are too many films by the same filmmaker and start voting the other way, it might have actually come to bear here, where finally where they see that Coppola name up three times potentially and realizing, okay, one's going to have to go. Not only was it probably going to be Apocalypse Now compared to the Godfather films, but Jaws, pretty stiff competition.
Yeah, it is. All right. The number four seed, The Godfather Part Two, went up against Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver.
Here's a note from Stephen Cherry. For me, though, it's very personal. I was a teenage boy in New York. A friend called me to ask what I was doing the next day. I saw this movie today. I want to see it again, and I want you to see it. Taxi Driver was the first movie that created a mood, a feeling, the cinematography, the music. It was the first movie that put me inside the head of a character the way that's so easy to do in a written narrative. Taxi Driver is the movie that made me a watcher of movies, an appreciator of what film could do. It made me love movies.
Man, I'm getting nostalgic for Steven's experience of being able to walk into a movie theater in New York City in 1976 and watch Taxi Driver.
Yeah, no kidding. That must have been something.
Well, there weren't enough Stevens out there. Closer, the closest matchup that we have in the Elite Eight, Godfather 2 does triumph over Taxi Driver 60%-40%. That means our final four is The Godfather versus The Godfather 2. And the two most epic blockbusters of all time, the two movies that made the blockbuster, Star Wars versus Jaws.
So it could come down to art versus commerce, if you want to use those probably inappropriate terms, but that's kind of what it's looking like. Let me ask a question of the committee. So when you were organizing the brackets, you had to have known it was likely, potentially, there was a way to do this where it would be Godfather v. Godfather in the finals, right? As opposed to,
And we did, if you will, rig it, as is our prerogative, to make sure that if it did come down to Godfather versus Godfather, it wouldn't happen in the final.
Right, okay.
And look, another committee could say, well, the Godfather and Godfather Part Two should be the one and two seeds. Okay, but I think you can also say Jaws could be the two seed or the one seed. You know, Star Wars could be the one, two, or three. So
I think this.
I think we had these movies in the right order. Yeah. And I think ultimately, despite the fact that Coppola did start the tournament with four movies and he's only going to have one film left here at the end, that makes the most sense. I think it's more representative of the 70s. Now, when we did our bonus content review of The Godfather Part 2, that was only for our patrons. All those shows still accessible if you want to become a family member. Patreon.com/filmspotting. You said,
I'm not going to pick,
but I'm just saying this is obligatory. You can't avoid this. You do have to give us your pick here in this context. Who gets your vote? Godfather or Godfather Part 2?
Okay, so I'm glad the committee set it up this way. I think your reasoning is sound.
Finally, some praise.
We are going to have to make this choice. I'm just buying time, so it really doesn't mean anything. Okay, I guess having to vote in this ridiculous scenario, which holds no bearing on the larger conversation of which movie is better, I'll go with The Godfather and make the claim that probably will get me in trouble, but essentially everything you need to know or experience or learn about the Corleone saga, you know, in The Godfather. What The Godfather Part 2 does is enrich that, expand on that, deepen it, and follow it through. And so if I only am going to have one, it just makes sense to have The Table Setter, which is impeccable in its own right. It's The Godfather.
It is. We agree on that. Now, are we going to agree on Star Wars versus Jaws? I will note again that you are doing a scene-by-scene, frame-by-frame breakdown of Jaws at Ebert Interruptus. You are not doing that with Star Wars Episode 4, A New Hope. I can't imagine a world where I can't watch Star Wars, where I can't show it to my kids, where it wasn't part of my life, such a key part of my life. And it just has more meaning to me than a film that I recognize is a masterpiece, but recognize that much later in life. Here, I'm going Linklater. I'm going nostalgia. I'm going.
That's what I was just thinking.
I'm going with the film that got to me first, Josh. It's Star Wars.
Oh my gosh. Well, through the lens of Interruptus, you know, already confident Jaws is going to stand up to that frame by frame analysis. I think more of Star Wars could than people might say.
I agree.
Especially those who dismiss it as just a cultural product. I think there's a ton of craft there. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start a GoFundMe to have Richard Linklater do a rotoscoped version of Star Wars.
Okay.
Before we toss this in the incinerator.
Got it.
Which will make me feel better about voting Jaws.
But you are voting Jaws.
I think I got to go Jaws. I think I do. And plus, like, you know, I could relive probably every second of Star Wars in my mind right now if you asked me to. And I could probably do that for maybe 98% of Jaws after next week.
It'll be 100.
I will definitely be able to do that. But I could replay and relive. Plus, I have, you know, all the memories of me running around in the backyard as Han Solo, kind of getting mixed up. Those I can preserve. Those don't go in the incinerator. So I will always have those with
me. Not yet. We'll figure that part out later.
That's in our beautiful future.
Yeah, with modern technology. What Josh is really saying, everyone, is why do I need Star Wars when I have The Phantom Menace?
That's true.
As long as I can still watch The Phantom Menace.
Now I
know people are thinking, well, can there be a Phantom Menace if we got rid of Star Wars? You know what? We're not.
I think we've answered that.
We're not going to debate it now.
I think prequels still live. I think we've answered that previously. So thanks for making me feel even better, Adam.
Yeah, you can vote now in the final four of Film Spotting Madness Best of the 70s at filmspotting.net/madness. That's also where you can check out the bracket and the complete list of titles that made the tournament. Last week's leader in our prediction contest, Brett Fisher, remains in first place.
Wow.
We say congratulations to Brett. Yes, that key matchup was Jaws versus Apocalypse Now. This week, obviously, it's going to be Jaws versus Star Wars. The debate we just had, I'm sure, is one that's raging across the Film Spotting audience as we speak. The prediction contest leaderboard is actually about split between the outcome of that one. So we will see if Brett can hang on to his lead for another week. Brett does have Jaws going to the final. And I'll be honest, I have not looked at the voting in a little while, but I think this is a case where a Jedi might be more powerful than a shark, even a great white the size of Jaws.
That tracks.
Yeah. So, Brett, you know, you better try to get out the vote, get out there on social media, get your friends and family to go to filmspotting.net/madness and see what you can do to help your case with Jaws. Now, we have an internal contest. Me, you, our producer, Sam, Madness Godfather, the founding father of this event, listener Mike Merrigan, and last year's winner, Andy Hampton from Madison, Wisconsin, swooped in late. He missed our emails, but he got a bracket filled out, and Andy is doing it again. He's in eighth place overall.
Aren't you glad he showed up?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, Sam and me, we dropped to 145th place because, yeah, we both went Apocalypse Now over Jaws. You, despite correctly picking Jaws over Apocalypse Now, are mired in 358th place.
How is that possible? Aren't these like weighted?
I know.
Shouldn't I be getting more points for a major pick like that?
Yeah, that is the case. And that's how bad your earlier picks were, apparently.
Good gracious.
But it doesn't matter because this isn't all about winning. It's all about losing.
That's true.
You don't want to lose Film Spotting Madness. There is a penalty for that. And Mike, we're sorry. Thank you for suggesting Film Spotting Madness 8 years ago, but you're in 607th place.
And the regret is sinking in for Mike.
Again, you can vote in the final four now through Monday the 4th at 11 a.m. Central Time. Filmspotting.net/madness.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
All right, I have an admittedly insane idea, but if I don't ask you this, it's just, you know, it's going to haunt me the rest of my life.
What?
I want to keep talking to you. You know, I have no idea what your situation is, but I feel like we have some kind of, connection, right?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, right. Well, great. So listen, here's the deal. This is what we should do. You should get off the train with me here in Vienna and come check out the town.
What?
Come on, it'll be fun.
Ethan Hawke, of course, with Julie Delpy in 1995's Before Sunrise, directed by Richard Linklater. We did talk about and review favorably Linklater's new Apollo 10.5 earlier in the show, and we thought this was as good a time as any to revisit our top five from back in 2016, devoted to our top five Richard Linklater scenes. Now, Josh, did you glance at your list today when Sam posted it in our Slack? Did you refresh your memory? I knew that I had four Ethan Hawke scenes in my top five Richard Linklater scenes because I referenced that with Mr. Hawke when I interviewed him a few years ago. I was kind of surprised for me. I love that I asked you a question. I'm answering the question.
I'm used to it.
I'll let you answer it too. I was surprised that I went with such an obvious scene, as great as it is. I think at number four here, you're going to hear my explanation. Hopefully I had a very good take on why I had to do the McConaughey high school girls stay the same age speech, because, you know, it's just not too far off the beaten path. That's a pretty familiar, easy choice if you're thinking about Linklater, but I'm sure I had something insightful to say, right, Josh?
Yes. And what I like about your habit of doing this is it gives me time to come up with my answer. So really, I appreciate
it. I knew that. Yeah, that's what I was doing.
I know. Okay. Thank you. Pulling it up here, I guess we both hit a couple of Sunrise, a couple of Before films, right? We both hit Boyhood. And of course, not only did we both hit Dazed and Confused, but McConaughey, different McConaughey moments. But yeah, and then I think we offered a little variety in our lists too. So that was a fun one to do. We always, you know, it's interesting to think about when do we do scenes and when do we do films? Mm-hmm. And there's probably some instinctual reason behind that, why one filmmaker seems to lend themselves to one category or the other. But I think in this case, scenes worked out really well.
absolutely did. And who knows, a few more years of really good films like Apollo 10 and a half will revisit this and actually come up with a new list. I think his body of work certainly would justify that. We did pair this original top five with a review of Linklater's Everybody Wants Some, a movie that was one of my favorite of the year. I could certainly find some great scenes from that one. Since then, he's made a couple more films, Another Flag Flying in 2017, a very loose sequel, if you will, to Hal Ashby's The Last Detail. I don't even think the word sequel applies much. And in 2019, he made Where'd You Go, Bernadette, starring Cate Blanchett. I think we were both fairly favorable on Bernadette.
If I recall, I was at least mixed on the film, but definitely liked what Blanchett did. And I think there's a pretty great moment thinking of scenes with Kristen Wiig. Does that sound right? So
yeah, definitely.
An interesting one from Linklater for sure.
Yeah, and a better film than Another Flag Flying, I would say as well. There are two Linklater blind spots for me that I'll have to remedy at some point. I've never seen Suburbia. Is that what he made?
Yep.
Suburbia and The Newton Boys. I've never had the pleasure of The Newton Boys, but that's it for me.
Yeah, I think I've got those two and a couple of more, actually. So haven't been able to do that Linklater ranked list. Hopefully, as you said, at some point, we'll get to do that. Then maybe do our top five movies overall. See how things shake out as he's getting into a later phase of his career.
Let's go back to 2016 and our top five Richard Linklater scenes, beginning with your original criteria for the top five.
So this, as I said, I thought this would probably be easy because Linklater makes films that hit you on such a gut, emotional, personal level that they're just going to pop right up to you is what you remember. And in fact, I did go back and look at the reviews of his films that I've seen on, I wish I were a completist on him. I'm not, I'm close, on my website. And sure enough, in every one, you know, I try to do this in most writing, but there's a particular scene that I pulled out and talked about, even if it was only a paragraph review, because that those specific moments are what he nails so well. So it was a matter of, you know, I pulled listeners on Facebook and Twitter and got some good recommendations there too. But it was really a matter of just flipping through the memories and what has stuck with me from these intensely personal films he makes.
All right. What's your number five?
I'm going to start things off with a Wooderson scene. And it's my favorite of his from Dazed and Confused, L-I-V-I-N. It's when they're hanging out late at the football field and Matthew McConaughey's Wooderson, he's teasing Jason London's Pink about this code of conduct paper that he's supposed to sign for the football team.
Not to indulge in any alcohol, drugs, sex after 12, or any other illegal activity.
God, my shadow.
Later, baby. Found that in your glove compartment, man.
Well, you know you're the third person who's given me this today?
But what do you reckon you're gonna do?
I don't know, man. I'll probably end up signing it. I just don't want to give in so easy.
Man, it's the same bullshit they tried to pull in my day. You know, if it ain't that piece of paper, some other choice they're gonna try and make for you. You gotta do what Randall Pink Floyd wants to do, man. And let me tell you this. The older you do get, the more rules are gonna try to get you to follow. You just gotta keep living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
This is a variation on the speech that so many of his characters give. You see it sort of in Ethan Hawke in Before Sunrise. Jack Black even gives it in School of Rock. And it's all about conforming society, trying to squelch individuality or your own distinct dreams. Mm-hmm. It's not just Wooderson, though, that makes this scene so great. I love all the layers that are at work here. You know, as much as you want to say that sort of a screw the man attitude is the guiding ethos in Linklater's films, consider the other perspectives that are going on in this scene in particular. One of the girls hanging out with them, she makes fun of these star athletes for acting so oppressed.
Right.
She calls them out
on
it. Yeah, they're the kings of the school. And so, you know, the movie even goes on to depict that if anything, maybe they're the oppressors. Maybe they're the man to the freshman at least. And Pink also reveals, here's an interesting distinction for me from Everybody Wants Some, is this yearning for adulthood here, right? Maybe even maturity is something that he's looking forward to. He has that great line, if I ever call these the best years of my life, remind me to kill myself. Mm-hmm. And this is in the middle of a movie that's celebrating supposedly the best years of your life. So, so much going on here, tons of nuance.
Yeah, certainly one I strongly considered an honorable mention. And in fact, as I was watching it today, that line hit me where he says that about these being the best years of my life because it struck me for the first time that Wooderson is sitting right there on the field listening to that. And he's the one character who might actually take offense to that.
He's trying to relive
he's trying to relive it.
Those years
he
every
day.
He
doesn't want to ever leave. In fact, he says, I'm thinking about going back to school. It's not high school, but maybe a junior college or something. So yeah, he's trying to get back into it. Absolutely. Great pick there. For me, the way I came at this list was I went back to my Letterboxd ranking I did when Boyhood came out of Linklater's films, and it has moved around and shifted a little bit since I originally posted it, but I realized that I had five films in that top tier of Linklater for me that are just absolutely, for me, great films, films I adore. Before Sunset, Before Sunrise, Dazed and Confused, Boyhood, and Before Midnight. And there was this second tier of really good movies that I really badly need to see again, all of them, but I enjoyed them and or gave them very positive reviews. Fast Food Nation, Waking Life, Slacker, A Scanner Darkly, and School of Rock. Then there's the next tier that I would say are a little bit more mixed bag for me. Not bad films, certainly, but movies that I probably didn't appreciate as much as many people do. Bernie, Me and Orson Welles, and then Tape, another film featuring Ethan Hawke. And I'd say they go in descending order there. Bernie being by far the best film. Me and Orson Welles, I can kind of take or leave. And Tape really did nothing for me. That leaves at the bottom the only absolute misfire from Linklater's career so far, the Bad News Bears remake.
Yeah.
Two films of his I haven't seen, The Newton Boys and Suburbia. So not bad to be 14 out of 16, now 15 out of 17 with Everybody Wants Some, which I slot in right there at number six behind Before Midnight. So what I decided to do was not only pick from the Before trilogy, but pick from those five top tier movies, pick my favorite scenes. And by the end of it, Josh, I'll be honest, I had to go with two from one of those films. I ended up leaving one of them out, actually, because I love the film and I love these moments so much. And the film that has two scenes is my number five, Before Sunset, and it's the car scene where they've been walking after meeting at the bookstore, Jesse and Celine, and then he has a car there that's supposed to take him to the airport, ultimately, and they drive around for a little bit before they ultimately get off and go on their way. This is the moment where things get real. At this point, as a viewer, I'm enjoying their conversation. I'm enjoying just seeing these two characters be on screen again and seeing them see each other. They're kind of talking around up to this point, the fallout from their brief encounter in the previous movie. And it's this great example of how Linklater can really build momentum in a scene and kind of shift things on you tonally, because as she reveals more and more about her current relationship and her past relationships, she gets a little bit more agitated and then she finally confesses it.
You know, it's not even that. I was fine until I read your book. It stirred it up, you know. It reminded me how genuinely romantic I was, how I had so much hope in things, and now it's like I don't believe in anything that relates to love. I don't feel things for people anymore. In a way, I put all my romanticism into that one night, and I was never able to feel all this again. Like, somehow this night took things away from me, and I expressed them to you, and you took them with you. It made me feel cold, like if love wasn't for me.
I don't believe that. I don't believe that.
So the part that always really gets me there is when she says the line about how she put all her romanticism into that one night, and she doesn't think she can recapture it. Hawk just almost touches her on the leg to try to comfort her in that moment, but realizes that she may not need that in that moment. And even if she does, he's not the guy
to
give it to her. And he can't touch her. And she doesn't even notice that he tries. And as the conversation goes on and she's lamenting more and more what's been lost, how she isn't this person she once was, he then goes back at her with, you say all that, but you don't even remember us having sex. And when she says, of course I remember, I melt in that scene just like Hawk does at that revelation, because there is this kind of friction between them in this scene that proves there's truly something there. Like, this movie isn't just going to be a nostalgia trip or about them catching up on what they've been doing in the interim. There is still something between them that has to be reckoned with, or it wouldn't stir up those kind of emotions.
Yeah, it's the spark scene, right? Where where it does take that next step. My number four is coming from one of your mixed bag films, actually. It's Jack Black singing with the car stereo in Bernie.
There are a lot of good moments in that movie.
You know, it's a Linklater film that I like quite a bit initially, but it really has only grown on me. This is based on a true crime story. Jack Black plays the title character. He's this genuinely sweet, likely gay, deeply religious assistant funeral director in this small Texas town. He ends up befriending a widow played by Shirley MacLaine, and that has tragic results. Bernie is, as a character, this guy is just a mystery. There, you just have constant questions about him. What's underneath this insistently cheery facade? What are his true feelings for Marjorie? That's the MacLaine character. You know, basically you're wondering, maybe because we know the context, the real world context, but does this guy have a dark side? And when are we going to get a hint of it? Well, you would say no, he doesn't have a dark side based on this one single take scene. It's about 2 minutes long. Bernie's just driving in his car and he's singing along to the hymn, Love Lifted Me, on the stereo.
Love lifted me. Love lifted me. When nothing else could help them, love lifted me.
Like the times Bernie sings in church, this is a genuinely heartfelt musical performance by Black.
I remember us talking about that sequence a lot.
He's not doing his School of Rock shtick. I mean, I like School of Rock a lot, and I think Black's very funny when he does the musical comedy, but this is taking the music seriously. It's suggesting that the song is something that really matters to Bernie. And so, considering what happens later in the film, this moment of devotion, it really only adds to that mystery of who is this Bernie TD.
Yeah, another great choice. My number four is my Dazed and Confused Wooderson scene. And if we've already heard the L-I-V-I-N scene, then listeners can probably predict where I'm going to go. That's what I love about these high school girls, Josh. And it isn't the scene, as I recall, that we're directly introduced to Wooderson. We've already seen him before, but it's, I think, our introduction to the full glory that is Wooderson in that scene where he's standing with the Jason London character, the Wiley Wiggins character, and I don't have the other character, his name in front of me, but the friend to Jason London, the fellow football player, and they're standing outside the Emporium. That line is one of the most quotable and quoted movie lines ever. So right there, it gets some points. But I also always kind of loved about it how he steps out of line to deliver his line. Like, he's standing there talking to the guys, and then the girl walks by, and then he just kind of walks forward, almost like he's on a stage. It's this very theatrical moment, and that always stuck out to me. And then over the weekend, I did watch the Linklater documentary that was made about him. It's called 21 Years, and it's, look, it's not very good. It was available on demand. It's fine, I should say, actually, if you want to spend 78 minutes looking back on the films of Linklater. It's good. It's not going to give you a whole lot of really in-depth insight, but they talk about that scene and McConaughey, who truly is as fun to listen to talk about playing Wooderson as he is playing Wooderson. Yeah. He explains that what was kind of going through his mind at that point was the fact that he doesn't see Wooderson as expressing that to the guys next to him or anybody else. He's kind of not talking to anybody else in that moment. He's talking to the cosmos.
Yeah.
You know, it's his proclamation to the universe. And just with Wooderson, the ratio of perceived wisdom to actual wisdom is so vast that it makes him truly one of the most memorable cinematic characters ever. And McConaughey's a genius, and that's where we discovered it. So that's my number four.
So you're a freshman, right?
Yeah.
So tell me, man, how's this year's crop of freshman chicks looking?
Well, you're gonna end up in jail sometime really soon, I know that. But
no, man. Yeah. No, man, I tell you. Yeah. That's what I love about these high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age.
Well, speaking of lines that you instantly remember from Linklater's films, I've got one here for number three. Baby, you are going to miss that plane.
Oh, man.
We're here in Before Sunset. This is one of the great seduction scenes in movie history, I think, because it's so wily and underplayed here by Julie Delpy. So she, Celine, and Jesse, they've come back to her apartment, and this is despite the fact that he has to catch that plane, they're going to sit down, hang out, listen to Nina Simone. And Celine describes seeing her in concert and then does this sultry impersonation of the performance as Jesse sits on the couch and he's, I think you used this word earlier, melting, right?
Yeah.
He's just melting there.
No, what's great about it is it's part sultry and part really silly.
Well, it's her. It's absolutely in character with her. And she's talking about, because what do they share? One of the things they share is a love of music, mm-hmm. right? This has been a through line. And she's talking about Simone as a performer here. So it's another Linklater conversation about music. She's making good points. And at the same time, what is she doing? And the goofiness is part of this. She's slowly reeling him in, right? Ever so slowly.
She was so great. She was so funny in concert. She would be right in the middle of a song and then, you know, stop and walk from the piano all the way to the edge of the stage, like really slowly. And she'd start talking to someone in the audience. Oh yeah, baby. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. I love you too. And then she'd walk back, took her time, no hurry, you know.
I really like in this scene too, where Linklater fades out before there's any consummation. You know, Celine just tells Jesse, using her supposed Nina Simone voice, that he's going to miss the plane. And then she keeps dancing to herself slowly as if she's not in a rush. She's confident about what's going to happen, doesn't need to hurry to get there. Fade to black, perfect.
Baby. You are gonna miss that plane.
I know.
It is perfect. My number three is from Before Sunrise, the first film in the trilogy. And wow, was this really hard to pick only one scene. But the one I ultimately landed on is the fake phone call scene at the little cafe. And you were just talking about how Linklater sometimes has these characters engage in conversations about performances. He also likes to occasionally have great scenes that are exhibiting performances. They are about characters performing an extra layer beyond what the actors are doing in the scene. But film has always struck me, it's the great revealer. Just watching, as an audience member, you're watching other human beings experience things that we experience too, or in many cases, things we'll never experience. And here, it's the simulation of a phone call, talking to a friend on the phone. We've all done it a million times, but they put on this little performance with each other where she's calling her friend to explain that she's not going to be making it back to Paris on time. Don't be waiting for her, basically. She's met this guy.
Allô? Hmm? Vanny, c'est Céline.
Ah.
Comment ça va?
Ça va bien. Et toi?
Il m'est arrivé quelque chose d'incroyable.
I've been working on my English recently. Will you want to talk in English just for laughs?
Yeah, okay. That's a good idea. I don't think I'm going to be able to make it for lunch today. I'm sorry. I met a guy on the train and I got off with him in Vienna. We're still there.
Are you crazy?
Probably.
He's Austrian? He's from there?
No. He's passing through here too. He's American. He's going back home tomorrow morning.
Why'd you get off the train with him?
Well, he convinced me. I mean, actually, I was ready to get off the train with him after talking to him a short while. He was so sweet, I couldn't help it.
There's a tremendous amount of charm in Ethan Hawke, first of all, as he suggests that they should maybe talk in English, that he's been working on his English, mm-hmm. and maybe they should try that out so he can better understand her. And it's only in this little charade does he get to ask the question he really wants to know. He gets to ask, why did you get off the train with him? And she answers, of course. And it's also where she admits, I think that's when I fell for him. So she admits only through the course of this whole scene, that truly is a scene, that she has fallen in love with him. And maybe she's not being totally genuine, but there's enough there that you can see it in Hawk's face that he knows he's got her. He knows he's got enough. And that expression as he watches her talk, it's as if Hawk is saying, just feed me more. Just keep giving me more of this, because he is enjoying every bit of it. And the one thing I didn't have time to look up, and I'm sure listeners will set me straight on this, is during the conversation, she says that they had kissed, and he acts very surprised. And I can't remember in the chronology of the movie if they had kissed at that point or not.
Yeah.
Either way, it's her chiding him and making fun of him for how he kisses, or it's another great reveal that, oh, this is possible, right? Like, yeah. They haven't done it yet, but she's considered it as a possibility. And that's another revelation for him. And then, of course, it's his turn to have the phone call calling back home. But it's only through this performance that they are really being who they really are somehow, that they're really exposing themselves in something that is otherwise fake. And you talk about through lines, the end of Before Midnight, the end of the trilogy, is another scene where we end on a bit of hope, where the two characters are acting out something. They're doing a little bit of playing for each other and pretending, talking about this time machine.
Yeah, they haven't achieved that intimacy yet. So the construct allows them to get there, and it also fast forwards things, right? Because this is all going to happen in a matter of hours, and how will it believably happen? Well, this makes it seem like something that actually could bubble up between them. My number two comes from Boyhood, and it's Patricia Arquette's goodbye to Mason, her son. I talked about Arquette in our review giving the linchpin performance for me in Boyhood. Just the way she's always working at the movie's edges. She's avoiding any cliches as this stalwart single mother. And what we get then is a woman who's fully formed and also has this individual life journey that parallels Mason's own. So we're following her as much as we're following him. And I think we realize that in this scene, when we get to the end here between her and Mason, as he's packing to leave for college, she just breaks down.
You know what I'm realizing? My life is just going to go like that. This series of milestones. Getting married, having kids, getting divorced. The time that we thought you were dyslexic. When I taught you how to ride a bike. Getting divorced again. Getting my master's degree. Finally getting the job I wanted. Sending Samantha off to college. Sending you off to college. You know what's next? Huh? It's my funeral!
And I think I found this scene so moving because as she's cataloging these milestones in her life, and true to the point of the story, she's also listing some mundane memories, we realize that Linklater's found a way with the strategy and structure of this film, making it in segments over 12 years, to make us feel as if we've lived each and every one of those years with the family, specifically with Mason, and I think with Patricia Arquette's character too. So for me, you know, this is the moment where the cumulative power of Boyhood, I think that's really how that movie works. There isn't any grandstanding scene.
No.
But the cumulative power of it hit me with a thud in the chest for this one.
Man, it's so devastating. And if I didn't know for sure that you were going to choose it, it very well could have been my number one. But I'm pretty happy with where I came out instead, Josh. Before we get there, my number two is my second scene from Before Sunset. And it's, guess what, Josh? It's the ending. We're going to have some overlap here because for me, you talk about culmination. When I wrote about this movie upon rewatching it on Letterboxd, I said, is it just me or are Jesse's repeated attempts to delay his trip to the airport the equivalent of the knight's gamesmanship in The Seventh Seal, a condemned man's maneuvers to stave off death by prolonging the sublime? And it's hard to get more sublime than Julie Delpy and Nina Simone. And those maneuvers, they finally pay off as he ends up in her apartment. And I do think there's something about just the space there, Josh, and the intimacy of it, that we've seen them walking around Vienna all night. We've seen them walking around Paris. There's something different when now they're not just in her city, but they're actually her apartment together, right? And just them being there. And then, of course, as you said, the sexiness to an extent, but also the goofiness of her Nina Simone impression really stands out. And then as she delivers that line, baby, you are going to miss that plane. The slow track in on Hawk's face. Again, really subtle. It is a camera move.
Mm-hmm.
He isn't just plopping the camera down and letting it play out in a long take. And yet it's still kind of invisible the first time you see it. But when you rewatch it, you see just how subtle and graceful that track in is as he says, I know. It's gorgeous. And you're right. The ambiguity it ends on, it's a happy ending. You have to see it as somewhat of a happy ending while at the same time acknowledging that, like Before Sunrise, it is still ending on an ambiguous note. It doesn't tell us that they are going to live necessarily happily ever after. We're still left in that same state of wanting to know what is going to happen to them that we were left with at the end of that film. And that's why I think so many of us were excited 9 years later for Before Midnight. And of course, fits in with what I was saying too about performance. It's more of them performing for each other. But yeah, I mean, one of the best endings I can think of. It had to be on this list.
Let's stick with the Before trilogy for my number one. It's the listening booth scene way at the beginning from Before Sunrise. It seems maybe uncharacteristic to choose as my number one scene this single take with nobody talking. Because as we mentioned, you know, Linklater's so good at conversations and discussions in his movies.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, this, I think maybe it's because it's such a stark contrast to all of that. And really what so much of Before Sunrise is built upon, that it stands out and that I appreciate it. Here, they're in a record store and Jesse and Celine squeeze into this listening booth and they put on Kath Bloom's 1984 song, Come Here. We get, I think, about 80 seconds here of sustained flirtation. There's tension, there's intimacy, there's uncomfortable moments as they're not quite sure what to do in this close space together, but they're still haltingly exchanging these smiles and glances. And boy, I don't know if the documentary got into this at all, but I would love to know how many takes they may have done of that, or how much of that was, you know, this whole movie has the feel of improvisation, but
yeah,
these glances are so perfectly timed.
And yet it's
where
not.
One
Hawk
looks,
would tell you it's very scripted.
Really? Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, it seems that makes sense because when one looks and the other looks away, it's just
but you do wonder,
on
you're right,
point.
About the physicality
the
and
physicality
how scripted
is,
that is and how rehearsed. Absolutely. I was too. And that's a scene, Josh, that I was reminded of watching that documentary 21 years. And I thought for sure, oh, I'm going to throw Josh here. I'm going to come up with a stunner of a scene from my top five that he's never going to remember from Before Sunrise.
No way.
And you picked The Listening Booth.
You know what? It's the still I grabbed for the review I wrote,
wow,
which isn't that long, but that was the moment. So I just pulled that up. I was like, oh, yeah, that's
well,
where I'm going.
You were dead on with that scene.
You know what? I like how it ends, too. Speaking of how Before Sunset comes to a great ending here, Linklater cuts away from the booth while the song is still playing. So he lets the music go, mm-hmm, on. And then we see Jesse and Celine back out on the Vienna streets. And it just sustains what was a wonderful moment. But also, that's, you know, that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to sustain these brief hours that they have together. And this little, mm-hmm, sequence does that in miniature.
Yeah, it's amazing. It really is probably the best or second best scene in Before Sunrise. And the two things that really stick out to me about it is the way that Hawk reacts in one specific moment. There are all these awkward glances and flirty moments and them almost coming together. And there's one point about halfway through the scene where Hawk is looking at her and it somehow doesn't feel cliche at all, but it's the moment we've seen in movies a million times where you think he's about to move in, mm-hmm, and actually get the kiss. And she turns to look at him in that moment and the recoil, the "no, I wasn't about to do that,"
right,
kind of look on his face,
right,
is just priceless.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a beautiful acting moment. But what else stood out to me, and I hope I saw this right on YouTube, the way I looked at it, what really heightens that scene, everything about it, is the fact that it is a single take, but I'm pretty sure it was shot with someone holding the camera in the room, not on a tripod. There is a camera person in that booth with them. And so the camera is not urgently or certainly violently moving, but it is moving.
Hmm.
It gives you the sense, almost like a documentary, of you being in that space with those two characters. And it heightens so much just seeing that camera move a little bit. My number one scene, Josh, is from the movie Boyhood. And I wish that I could wax eloquently about it. The reality is, it's the dialogue that I know I spent some time on when we reviewed this movie, one of the many scenes like the goodbye scene that stood out to me. But also it's my number one because I think it truly sums up what I've learned about Linklater. If I've learned anything from reviewing Everybody Wants Some and putting together this list, what really cuts through the heart of his work, and you touched on all those things that make up his ethos, but you didn't mention what I think is maybe the most overriding theme in that ethos, and it's the notion that magic is in the everyday. That magic is in reality, not in fantasy or the types of moments we try to fabricate out of reality, looking for meaning. The meaning is there if you'll just look for it, and you'll just open yourself up to it a little bit. And where that is really articulated so eloquently is in Boyhood, when Ethan Hawke, again, is talking to Mason, the dad, and his son, and he's fairly young at this point. I want to say maybe 10 or 12, and he asks him, he says, "Dad, there's no magic in the world, right? There's no real magic." And Hawk has that kind of answer that, you know, maybe only a dad in a Richard Linklater movie could come up with. He's the dad I kind of wish I could be, where my kids ask me a serious question like that and I have the perfect answer. But he lays it out for him. He says, "What makes you think that elves are any more magical than something like a whale?"
You know what I mean? What if I told you a story about how underneath the ocean there was this giant sea mammal that used sonar and sang songs, and it was so big that its heart was the size of a car and you could crawl through the arteries? I mean, you think that's pretty magical, right?
Yeah.
I think if you watch all of his films, more than anything, Linklater is about trying to make us not take for granted those things that just go by every day. And I think that's articulated as well in Everybody Wants Some, but it's certainly at the core of so much of Boyhood.
Yeah, and what's so beautiful about that scene is that it's embedded exactly in that moment. It doesn't come across as a thesis statement at all.
No.
It's the interaction between father and son, as you're talking about.
This father and son, and you believe
exactly,
it.
Exactly. So it just works beautifully.
Those are our top five Richard Linklater scenes or moments. Josh, did you have any honorable mentions?
I thought about the, it's almost a Kiarostami-like opening car scene of Before Midnight,
totally.
When we suddenly reconnect with Jesse and Celine, and they're now married, and we immediately sense this new tenor of caution, I think, that's there in their exchanges. Your number one, it was probably my number six, I would say. I think it is a good description of Linklater's style overall. Really funny scene in Dazed and Confused, almost a throwaway one, but the girls in the bathroom giving this feminist deconstruction of Gilligan's Island just cracks me up. And then A Scanner Darkly, you mentioned in your rankings there. It's one I like as well. Mm-hmm. And of course, visually interesting with the rotoscoping animation going on. That has a single take where Keanu Reeves is walking into this, I think it's the drug house, and we just follow him there until he goes and flops on a couch. And just the camera work is very disorienting in a way, working alongside the rotoscoping that just captures the whole air of that uneasy film. Mm-hmm.
Well, just sticking with the five movies I mentioned that I was focusing on, obviously the listening booth scene from Sunrise, the ending and the beginning scene you mentioned, Josh, from Before Midnight, the ending being the This Is Real Life bit. Dazed and Confused, I had your L-I-V-I-N scene, but also my little moment that cracks me up every time I see it, and again, is just another thing Linklater would think to capture. It's during the party scene at the end of Dazed and Confused. It's just one of the snapshot kind of moments that Linklater captures where Cole Hauser, the actor, is sitting on the hood of a car with other people too, and he just decides for no apparent reason that he's going to stand up. And he kind of stands up, and it looks like he's almost stretching in a way that he's saying to the world, you know, I'm a god, like I own this place. And he stands up, and as soon as he gets up and raises his hands, he immediately realizes he has to sit down. You know, like he's just too drunk to actually stand up, and he's got to sit down. And then from Boyhood, the end scene, Seize the Moment. And of course, as you touched on, I thought there'd be more. And certainly there are a lot more scenes and moments we could have considered for this top five Richard Linklater scenes. Please send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
Gilligan's Island? It's what's called a male pornographic fantasy.
Oh my.
Think about it. You're basically alone on a deserted island with two readily available women. One, a seductive sex goddess type. The other, a healthy girl next door type with a nice butt. So guys have it all. The Madonna and the whore. Women get nothing.
From April 2016, those were our top five Richard Linklater scenes. You can find our top five picks in the top five archive. Just go to filmspotting.net/lists. That's our show, Josh.
If you want to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Letterboxd, you can find us at Film Spotting and at Larson on Film. In the show archives at filmspotting.net, you can find reviews, interviews, and top fives going back to 2005. That's also where you can vote in the final four round of Film Spotting Madness Best of the 1970s. 64 films enter. We're down to four. Only one remains. To order show t-shirts or other merch, visit filmspotting.net/shop. And you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter at filmspotting.net/newsletter.
Out wide this weekend, you can see Jared Leto sinking his teeth into his role as a Marvel vampire. That's Morbius. Josh, are you going to see Morbius?
I don't think I will make it to Morbius.
Okay. Out on digital, you can see on Netflix, Apollo 10 and a half, the latest from Linklater. You can also see The Bubble. How about this? A new Judd Apatow movie on Netflix that completely has flown under my radar. The cast and crew of a blockbuster franchise attempt to shoot a sequel while quarantining. That's what we're getting from The Bubble, Josh. More likely to see that than Morbius?
Yes, absolutely. And like you, not on my radar at all until maybe 2 weeks ago.
Okay. In limited release, you can get prepped for a movie we're going to discuss in a couple weeks here on the show. Everything, Everywhere, All at Once, the latest from Daniels, starring Michelle Yeoh. Again, next week, we don't know, but when we figure it out, we'll post it over on filmspotting.net/episodes. We do plan to have a show. Maybe I'll just leave it blank. Maybe I'll go, I don't know, to Cancun or something for spring break.
That sounds wonderful. Either that, or you're just going to have to sit here and ask yourself questions. Film Spotting.
You know I could fill an hour with that.
I have no doubt. Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Betty Lavendero. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.